You have tuned in to an encore presentation of Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM. Thanks so much for listening.
Now, I'm doing everything I can humanly imagine to do, short of waterboarding, to get these folks to negotiate.
We don't get a free attorney. We don't get a free call. Right now, people are not getting even hearings.
Is this all you guys have? Okay. Right, so you're not going to say, you're not even going to say anything.
Okay. It's Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris, and your host tonight. Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson, American Carnage Report host and producer Dave Willingham, and a very special guest host, County Councilman Carl Weimer. Thank you so much for being here, Carl, and everyone. We have a lot of subjects today to cover, a lot of news that has been happening. We are going to have a special session report because we had hoped the session would be over today, and of course, it is not, and we have a lot to say about that, but we are going to start with our governor. Jay Inslee had a lot to say about it as well.
Legislative session is scheduled to end on Sunday. Unfortunately, the legislature has not been able to reach agreement on the budget and has yet to begin negotiations that will be required to reach the eventual budget. This job cannot wait, and it is my intention to call the legislature back at 10 a.m. Monday for a special session to get this job done. It is most disappointing that the state of Washington and the people of this state are in this position again. We know none of the budgets that have been proposed so far, the Republicans, the Democrats, or mine, will be the final go-home budget. The go-home budget will by necessity be a compromise among all three. But for this to happen, for the people of the state to have what they need, legislators need to talk, and they need to trade offers to resolve the entire budget of the state of Washington. I heard something recently said about budget negotiations. I read Senator Rossi said, quote, it's kind of like fishing. You just got to be patient, close quote. That's the lassitude and the attitude that has got us into this position. Our students, our teachers, and our families deserve better. They deserve legislators to do their job. And their job starting Monday is to negotiate. Education funding is the top priority this session. But there are obviously other significant budget items that remain to be worked out between the parties. They include mental and behavioral health, where we have critical needs. They include funding for early education, for state need grants, and the state's collective bargaining agreements to keep our hospitals open and our state patrol on the job. I expect legislators will continue to work on other issues during this special session. And as long as they get the job done on education, they should also continue working on those. Now, I do want to point out that the legislature has produced some good results for the state of Washington this year on a bipartisan basis. So we know that legislators can come together. They can get hard things done when they negotiate. This is not a time for stunts. It's not a time for just statements of intent. It is not helpful. It is not entertaining. And it is unproductive. We know the Senate Republicans are not on the same page with the House regarding revenues. They don't have to pass bills to let us know that. We know that the parties are going to have to compromise. They don't have to pass bills on the floor of the Senate to do that. We know two things with absolutely certainty, and I can save the Senate a lot of time on this. The House budget won't pass today in the Senate, and the Senate budget today won't pass in the House. Now, that's pretty obvious. Both sides are going to have to move towards another, and both sides are going to have a responsibility to move towards one another. Unfortunately, at the moment, we only have one side willing to start that negotiation process. We need two sides to do that. Now, I'm doing everything I can humanly imagine to do, short of waterboarding, to get these folks to negotiate. But the Republicans have refused to date. I'll continue to encourage them. I'll continue to try to make it easier for them. I think that I am trying to help them by telling them today, House is going to have to compromise. The House is going to have to drop some of their ideas and requirements. I will have to do the same thing. All of us will have to reach a compromise, and I think that's a sign of good faith, and that's what we need in these negotiations.
And that was Governor Jay Inslee getting feisty about the special session and the frustrations that we have in trying to get a budget resolved in this state. Dave, thank you so much for preparing the audio. You said that there were only four reporters at that press conference.
Yeah, it was kind of sad because I thought that was one of the best speeches that I've seen Inslee give. And even during the question period, he was more kind of animated and fluid than I've seen him before, and it's a sad state our legislative coverage right now. We used to have a much broader, more diverse, stronger press corps down there, and it's been greatly diminished.
I could give a short plug that this is the time for community news and community eyes and ears, and we support and encourage citizen journalism. So get in touch with us at Cascadia News Now if you have something to report. Meanwhile, Dave, tell us, where are we with the dang budget?
Well, as the governor said, we're now in a 30-day special session. Four people showed up on the state Senate on Monday, and they adjourned until today. And so the reason we're here is because we don't have a budget. And we don't have a budget because some people don't want us to have a budget. They have yet to schedule negotiations on a budget. They're still doing some negotiations on the education fix for the McCleary decision. But without the broader budget discussions, I don't know where they're going to get with that. But some people have decided that paying state representatives $120 a day plus travel plus staff is cheaper than sitting down and working it out.
Okay, but you're saying that some people don't want us to have a budget, but no representative is saying that. Every representative is saying that the other party doesn't want us to have a budget.
Well, that's true, but there is a definable group that isn't willing to schedule negotiations, and that definable group are state Republicans, specifically Senate Republicans, in a faction led by Dino Rossi, who was not elected to this position. He was appointed to fill it. He's not running for re-election. He really doesn't have anything particularly to lose, but he feels that by drawing the process out, probably until we're on the eve of shutdown on July 1st, he can, you know, use that for leverage and get more of what their team wants.
Now, my understanding of this session is that not everyone that is involved in the legislature needs to come in at an early stage. It's mostly the people that are the budget writers. That was my understanding. And are you saying that the budget writers themselves are not showing up?
Some of them are. The House Democrats budget team was there on Monday. They have been there so far this week. It's not the House Democrats that aren't showing up here, and it's kind of hard because I'm a partisan guy. I like my teams, but I don't want to talk about it in that way. I want to be able to, you know, give a fair assessment. But in this case, the fair assessment is one of the teams isn't showing up to play.
Well, even if you're fiscally conservative and even if you are wanting to reduce taxes, you were elected to show up and to fight for those values. And I think it's the not showing up that's frustrating.
And a special session for 30 days can run over $500,000. Wow. There's nothing fiscally conservative about that.
I got to ask you, Carl, since you're sitting right here, what are you concerned with being impacted in as far as our county's concerned?
Well, there's lots of concerns for the county, especially as they put the budget off, because we're on hold right now with the Hearst decision that we're going to talk about a little later on water, because there's a fix moving through the legislature on that. I think that's being used as a negotiating point as part of the budget. There's lots of issues with mental health issues, affordable care issues, and it's not really fair to the public for them just to point at each other and blame each other and not get into the negotiation discussion so we can hear what the real issues are that the problems are at, where the problem is.
Does our county have any, I mean, obviously it's not your fight to fight, but do you have any say? Do you have any more, do you carry any more weight in terms of trying to reach out to our representatives?
Well, perhaps. I think electeds have listened to electeds, and we have a lobbyist down there that works some of the issues for us. So we try to chime in, but we're far from the emperor often.
My understanding is that a couple of years back that the city and the county and the port pooled their lobbyists, so they have a joint lobbyist. So that actually should give a little bit of leverage, because the demands are fewer, and the force that's put forward to the legislature for Whatcom County and its governments is probably a little stronger and more cohesive than that in the past.
Right. So they are hearing from three of us at a time when the lobbyists speak. And the county executive and council members have been down there, too. And I know the city council members have been down there, too, trying to, you know, find out what's going on instead of being left hanging until, you know, some point in June.
Well, that's a very good point. That there are so many projects, and I again want to give a plug for fiscal.wa.gov. It is an excellent site, has a lot of information about all of the proposed budgets. There are interactive maps. You can come down to Whatcom County and you can see what projects are specifically included in what areas. It's really worth your time to go and have a look at what they're talking about down in Olympia.
Again, that was fiscal.wa.gov. We'll throw that up on our Facebook page as well. And so what else specifically about the budget and the process that is not a process? What can we expect to see in the next couple weeks?
I think we're going to see a lot of finger-pointing and a lot of stunts. We've already seen that with the State Senate. They introduced the proposed funding plan that was included in the House budget into the Senate to get people to vote for or against it. I believe all of it got voted down because it was a stunt. And I think we're going to see that until we get a little further in this process, until the heat is higher. And in the meanwhile, there are other bills. There are bills that were introduced during the session that didn't make it through that they're looking at now again. So it's not like nothing is happening. It's just that the important thing, the thing that means the most and is the biggest deal, which is the budget, and by, you know, attached to it, the education fix just isn't getting there.
I'm sorry, Dave, I don't want to put you on the spot with this question, but the water fix, Hearst water fix that Carl had mentioned earlier, is there any possibility that's going to come back? Because it didn't make it out of committee. So what's the mechanism in the legislature that would allow something like that to come back to life?
Well, they can move by resolution now in this phase to bring things forward. They stay in the exact same place they were before, so that's still in committee in the House. It's passed the Senate. So the House can move it forward, and that will probably be one of the as Carl said, one of the sticking points in the negotiations. That's one of the, we'll give you part of this if you'll do this, but we can't get there if they're not talking.
So the Hearst stuff and all of the bills that may have movement now have to be budgetary, meaning that they have to involve. No, is that not true?
That is not necessarily true. Okay. At this point. There are mechanisms for moving regular bills, because we're in kind of a special state where, you know, we've already passed the deadlines. So
deadlines don't apply anymore.
Sort of. You know, there are still some, but they have a little bit more leeway. And by moving things through by resolution, that kind of puts them back into play.
So things that we thought were dead could rise again from the dead.
In theory, and there's going to be a lot of push on that. But, you know, one of the One of the ones that is getting a little bit more pressure on it is the House earlier in the session passed a bill that would prevent Washington State from accumulating a registry of people by religion. And that went through the House. It's in committee in the Senate. They've brought it forward. So it's back in committee in the Senate. So that could see movement. There's a internet privacy bill. Senator Kevin Ranker's bill accumulated almost as many co-sponsors as there are state senators.
On both sides?
Yeah. Well, almost all of them, and did not move from committee. But a similar proposal out of the House passed the House and is in Senate committee.
Let's back up and explain that. The internet privacy bill, why do we suddenly need internet privacy? Don't we already have that?
So there's been a change to a FCC regulation where Congress has struck a rule that says that internet service providers cannot sell browsing data as advertising fodder. It can't they can't turn around and sell that. That has to be kept private. That was struck by our Congress and signed by our president. Senator Ranker introduced a bill to reintroduce those protections in Washington. There's a similar one that we were just talking about that's made it to the Senate. It's a little bit more comprehensive, but wouldn't take effect until June 2018, even if it does pass. So
that, and I think that bill is interesting to me because, or that effort, because what it really shows is the schism between conversations that are going on at the federal level, conversations that are going on at the state level. I mean, this thing went jammed forward through the Congress, but when it came back to Washington State, all the senators, even Republican senators, are like, what? What's this about? This is not right. Washington needs greater protection. So I think it's an interesting little dialogue because it just shows that there's not a monolithic mindset on this issue, whether Democrat or Republican, national to state or even local.
Absolutely. We have just a minute left, and there's a lot to cover, but unfortunately, we'll probably be back here next week. Do you want to touch on education? I know there was some hearings about that today.
They're continuing to have hearings. They're continuing to negotiate on a plan. It is somewhat hopeful to me that they're making some progress there, but again, it's fettered to the whole budget discussion, so it could all blow away.
So we'll be paying attention to that. Going back to the budget and who thinks who is doing anything, there was a lovely video that got passed around just a couple of days ago where our own 40th District Senator Ranker happened to come across somebody holding a sign saying, "Why aren't Democrats doing something about taxes?" standing next to a human in a chicken suit. We are going to share that audio with you right now.
We are wondering why the Democrats have a
here, budget
proposed, but haven't voted on it.
The Senate Republican package has $670 million in taxes that they haven't voted for, and that it would be the single largest property tax increase in state history. It's a $5.5 billion property tax increase. Are you guys supportive of that?
I didn't say. I was just wondering why the Dems. I've heard commercials for the Dems House package, and if they're confident in it, I just was wondering why they haven't voted on it.
Where do you live? Like, just give me the region. I don't need it.
Oh,
because I've got a map.
Sound.
I can show you exactly what your property tax increase would be.
Yeah.
Under the Republican proposal. So, for instance, if you lived in Whidbey Island, you will have a 38% across the board property tax increase. If you live in the Seattle greater area, you'll have about 100% property tax increase. So that's a concern to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe you need a tax package that doesn't just rely on property taxes, because it disproportionately hits people, particularly in the Puget Sound region, but also Okanagan, Tri-Cities,
mm-hmm.
gets slammed.
Yeah.
So that's not okay, right?
No. And I'm not saying it is okay.
But the Republicans haven't done theirs either, because they put theirs out to a vote of the people, so that's not passed.
But they put theirs out to a vote of the people, mm-hmm. like you just said.
Yeah.
The Dems haven't, so they have
when do you know when the vote actually happens?
If I'm hearing things on the radio saying support the package, the budget, I want to know why they haven't voted. Is the reason that we're out here. I'm just raising a question, not, and that's it.
You don't really have an idea what the Republicans' property tax proposal actually does to people across the state, right?
That's not what I'm worried about.
You're not worried about increased taxes for poor people and the elderly?
I didn't say that. I'm worried about the House, because that's the chamber that the Democrats control.
Oh, so you're against the Democrats. That's why you're here.
I didn't say that. The Democrats, and they have Jay Inslee, so the likelihood of their package getting through and having an easier way of getting signed into law is greater because Jay Inslee's in the governor's mansion.
What about you, Chicken? What's your name? What? Oh, okay, that's really good. Is this all you guys have? Right, so you're not even going to say anything. Yeah, okay. That makes sense. It's par for the course.
If you are going to wear a chicken suit and you're going to protest taxes, I think the moral of this story is that you should probably find out Senator Renker's schedule and make sure he's in committee all day, because, that was awesome. We will post the video to our Facebook page. That is Cascadia News Now at Facebook. I am Stephanie Contouris, and you are tuned in to Cascadia News Now with County Councilman Carl Weimer and Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham. Going to a more serious subject, we've been reporting continually on the hunger strike in Tacoma at the Northwest Detention Center. Our own citizen journalist, Liz Darrow, was in Tacoma this week, and she had an eye-opening experience.
The Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma has been operating as an administrative processing facility for undocumented immigrants. In early April, detainees began a hunger strike to protest inhumane conditions in the facility. Their complaints included that they were being served beans and rice at least 6 days a week. They were not allowed access to clean uniforms, and many of the women had gotten infections from wearing the same pair of underwear for weeks at a time. Additionally, detainees complained that they were being forced to maintain the facility themselves for a dollar or less per day. During the second week of the hunger strike, I traveled to Tacoma to offer support and to learn more about the situation. Outside the detention center, I met Bill and Ann, volunteers with Aid Northwest, Advocates for Immigrants in Detention Northwest. Bill and Ann operate out of an RV parked right outside the detention center. The inside of the RV is decorated with beautiful handmade crafts given to them as gifts of thanks from detainees who have been released. Ann tells me that hearings usually happen late in the afternoon, but they never know whether detainees will be released or not.
It's 6 o'clock already and no one's come out.
Yeah.
So that's not so good.
Most people are deported. Yes. The vast percentage of people inside are deported. Very few come out.
The services we offer include access to a telephone and communications with either their attorneys or their families or whoever else they might need to contact. And then just some refreshments and so that they can just sit and gather their thoughts. And I guess almost everyone needs a backpack.
Yep.
Or a small duffel bag so that they can carry their meager belongings with them. And then we have these donated clothes so that they can have a little more dignity when they travel. Also shaving kits and women's female supplies, things like that, that they're going to need. Because obviously this place was located so far from anywhere where they would have those kind of resources.
The detention center is situated in an industrial area of Tacoma's Tide Flats. It's so inconspicuous that Ann tells me many people who live in Tacoma don't even know that it's there. And it's a long ways from anything that a person might need when being released from detention. No bus lines, no gas stations, no payphones. As I'm talking with Bill and Ann, a large bus with a GEO logo pulls up to the detention center. GEO is the corporation who owns the facility. We get out of the RV to watch as the bus pulls through one barbed-wired gate and then another. Ann tells me that GEO makes $137 per night per detainee they bring into the facility.
We could be much cheaper keeping them at the Motel 6. But no, it's GEO. GEO gets the money, and we pay it. And their contract, they have a 10-year contract. It was renewed last year. It's criminal, really.
Outside the barbed wire fence surrounding the detention center, Northwest Detention Center Resistance has set up an encampment to show solidarity with the detainees. I talked with Mara Mora, who is in her second week of camping out here in support of the hunger strikers.
We're right now in an encampment outside the detention center, the largest detention center for immigrants in the West Coast, one of the largest throughout the nation. This place has grown in the past 13 years, three times. Now the maximum capacity is 1,575. So the place is at capacity. It's the only one in the Northwest. So we have people from everywhere in the nation, really, not only the Northwest, coming to Tacoma. We are undocumented-led, detainee-led, deportee-led. We believe that the only way this place is going to disappear is from the inside, having the leadership of people currently detained telling us how to fight this place and ensure it's gone. So what we want to do is to bring attention to this, to remind everybody deportation doesn't solve absolutely anything. When people say, oh, they committed a crime, so what? That's supposed to be solved by the criminal system.
In fact, many of the detainees here are not criminals. They are people who have been stopped for routine traffic violations, like having a taillight out. The likelihood that the police will act as immigration officers creates a fear that causes barriers for the criminal justice system. The 1,600 people detained here are not criminals, but the conditions they are forced to live under are inhumane.
The government has a problem with us not working with a valid social security number, but they have no problem having working people there for a dollar a day or for nothing. They have chosen which parts of the criminal system to use in within a civil system, but they decided not to give us the few rights that you have in the criminal system. We don't get a free attorney. We don't get a free call. Right now, people are not getting even hearings. People have been complaining about their hearings being postponed for months. So it's the perfect system to build a machine where people will be placed. They will make money out of their bodies and their families that need to be placing money every week so they can survive inside. And then they will be disposed of them by deporting them. So at the end of the day, detention, deportation, it only benefits corporations. They don't care about human rights, and they don't care that people know that they don't care. So we're not pretending to negotiate with a fascist regime. There's nothing to negotiate with them because freedom is not negotiable. We need to change the culture that believes that people need to be placed in cages. There's so many ways to solve problems when somebody makes a mistake in our society. What kind of society are we that believe that people should be caged? We cannot allow this caging of bodies inside while their families are outside not knowing how their loved ones are inside, what they're going through. This is nothing but torture.
I met one of the families of a detainee outside the detention center, a young mother and her three-year-old boy. She declined an interview for fear that there would be consequences to her family. But she did tell me that she drove up that morning from Oregon and had been waiting for 3 hours, not knowing whether her husband would be released or not. She said she didn't know why he was there, but had been contacted by an attorney who said he might have a hearing today. Moments after talking with her, the gates behind me opened and a young man walked out. Immediately, the little boy jumped from the back seat of the car and ran across the parking lot, into the man's arms. The scene was overwhelming, a happy reunion under devastating circumstances. He was the only detainee released. Maru tells me she believes it is within our power to shut the detention center down.
We are calling for the public opinion to be here, to be present, to say, we need to change this. We can change it. We created it, right? We allow for that creation to happen. Therefore, we're able to undo it, to dismantle it, and create something totally new. There's societies in the world that don't rely on these kind of systems. Nowadays, you can have an opinion, but if you don't express it, it's not worth anything, right? You need to say it. You need to be out there. You need to be public, because these systems rely on people being quiet, people being accepting of the conditions, or people being afraid. We believe that this is a very critical moment in history where people actually can participate. I've always thought to myself, what is going to happen in the future when you see, you know, what the history was for this country and your children ask you, where were you? And you say, I don't even know where I was. And you are responsible for the for whatever outcomes we live at that moment.
For Cascadia News Now, I'm Liz Darrow.
And Liz Darrow told me that there were 750 people at the height of the hunger strike, which has now ended, not like 2014, where there were some compromises made, but according to Liz, that ended because of retaliation from the detention center. Detainees were threatened with solitary confinement. They were told that they would be forced to have IV fluids, and many strikers were sent to other detention centers so that they would not have strength in numbers. Liz, thank you very much for that report. You are listening to Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham and KMRE.org. I'm Stephanie Contouris here in the studio with my co-host Dave Willingham, Tim Johnson, and tonight, County Councilman Carl Weimer. Hi there, and thank you for coming. We were hoping to talk about an impending vote that was supposed to happen next Tuesday regarding the Cherry Point Comprehensive Plan. Carl, and what is actually happening now?
Yeah, it got postponed until May 16th is when the public hearing on those Cherry Point amendments will happen now. And I think it got postponed so we could do it kind of in conjunction with some other comp plan amendments that have to do with Point Roberts that are totally unrelated.
But you've been wanting this to be resolved for a while now?
Oh, yeah. You know, we worked on our comp plan all of last year, and I was hoping to have these resolved as part of that comp plan discussion last year. So put them forward in July and August of last year, and then we were told that because of a variety of procedural things, it had to go back through the Planning Commission. So that's why it's taken so long. But I think we're close to wrapping it up.
So let's just break this down. What is a Cherry Point Comprehensive Plan? If I've never heard of it before, how would you explain it?
Well, the comprehensive plan is kind of the aspirational goals and policies that the county sets on a whole wide variety of issues. And Cherry Point is one of our industrial developed areas, a UGA for industrial development.
UGA?
Urban growth area.
Okay.
So it's been set aside for heavy industrial development for years and years now. You know, as the council looked at that last year, we thought, yes, it's set aside for that. We want to support the businesses that are there, but we're sitting right in the crosshairs of all kinds of potential proposals for moving a variety of fossil fuels offshore from Cherry Point. We've seen the coal trains coming through here. We've seen oil trains coming through here, all impact the potential safety of our community. And we wanted to move forward in ways that, and look at ways that we could protect the, increase the safety of the community and perhaps address some of those fossil fuel exports.
Could you characterize some of these amendments? I mean, what do they say? What do these amendments attempt to do?
Great question, because I think there's been a lot of mischaracterization of it, because the amendments do very little, actually. You know, I think the main amendment basically is the county council asking that we want to hire some outside expertise to tell us where our authority lies when it comes to Cherry Point. You know, people want us to ban oil exports. You know, there's federal law that doesn't allow local governments to ban things like that. People want us to stop oil trains coming through Bellingham. There's laws that may not allow us to do that. So we want some expertise from the outside to tell us what the constraints of our authority is and give us ideas on things we can do to make the community safer and perhaps address exports. That's the main part. It's just a study, and then the council can do, after the study's done, choose to do what they want with that.
Well, there's so many players in this situation, and I know a lot of us are thinking about what just happened with SSA Marine and the Lummi Nation and the Army Corps of Engineers. And so explain to me how you and these amendments and how the county council fits in with all of these players and who has boundaries over what.
And that's exactly kind of what the county council is asking to study for, to kind of define that for us. You know, we're not constitutional lawyers. We're not land use experts. So we really are looking for, you know, the city of Portland was dealing with the same thing and passed an ordinance dealing with exports within their boundaries. We want to have a similar study to tell us what our relationship is to the Army Corps of Engineers and the feds. People throw up the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution and say we can't do anything because it's all part of commerce and that's the federal government's business. Local governments go away. Other places have successfully used their zoning and planning rules and safety, health and safety rules to steer development in certain ways. And so that's what we're trying to wrap our heads around.
Last fall, Intalco sold some of its leasing rights out of its pier to a company called Petrogas, and they are currently exporting propane gas. And this thing kind of went into at the same time that the council was trying to put forward these Cherry Points amendments. This project came through. Maybe you can you talk a little bit about the Petrogas project and how that fits in to both the amendments that are proposed and also the moratorium that is in place, so that you guys have time to figure these issues out and study these amendments?
Sure, that's a perfect example of one of those multiple proposals that I don't think any of us saw coming 2 years ago. While everybody's been focused on coal and oil trains and even a new pipeline that's proposed across the north part of the county, no one really saw that one. Petrogas, a company out of Calgary, multiple owners from around the world came in and they bought a small facility that's operated a propane export off the Intalco pier for years. And then just last year, they worked out an agreement with Intalco to actually purchase the pier. There's some indications that the amount of propane coming through by train has increased quite dramatically, and there are plans to ship more propane from that pier, another fossil fuel. The way that kicks in is they spent hundreds of millions of dollars to create that purchase, so they have some kind of a scheme in the works to make that money back. We don't know what that is. We've asked, haven't got a lot of clarity. So our current amendments to the comp plan and the moratorium that are in place would prevent them from building more tanks and increasing rail and ship traffic out there at this point if our moratorium is legally sound.
Right. One more question. You wear another hat, and that is that you're the director of the Pipeline Safety Trust. And that gives you sort of a little bit of inside knowledge about the nature of volatiles that are shipped primarily through pipeline, but also train. How does propane factor in? Where does it rest in terms of volatiles when it's compared to something like the oil trains that are coming through Whatcom County already?
Well, that's interesting because the ex-administrator of the Pipelines and Hazardous Material Safety Administration, who oversees federally all the regulations on this, when you talk about all the different materials pipelines carry, gasoline, jet fuel, crude oil, propane, the one that he says scares him the most is propane in those types of highly volatile liquids, because if they get out of containment, they act like a liquid for a while until they turn into a gas. So they can flow a long ways, turn into a gas until they find an ignition source and then blow up.
And
propane is very scary.
But it hasn't really been on our radar in a community sense as much.
No. How about why is the county council trying to kill jobs? Let me ask you that. What's the job? How does the job equation? Because that comes up a lot, as you know.
What's wrong with you guys anyway?
Why do you guys hate jobs?
Yeah, every driving home to my house, I go past all these preserved Cherry Point job signs. I actually have one in front of my house. And I don't have a problem with that because the county council has bent over backwards to make sure that the amendments we're working on don't do anything to harm the existing businesses out there and the processing of fuels at Cherry Point and the use of them in the United States. What we just don't want to become is the mega export facility. And there's places around where, and there's lots of evidence that if a refinery starts exporting, they may be losing jobs. And we've even had union people come to the county council and say that they kind of support what we're doing because of the fear that some of the refineries could become just export facilities and ratchet down the number of jobs refining fuels here in this country.
Right. That's a question that I had because, there's always these economic multipliers. But it seems to me, it strikes me that the export is mostly involved in turning valves and moving things from place to place. Very specifically, it's not refining the fuel. It's taking unrefined product and shipping it elsewhere where the jobs are. Is that kind of
exactly? The refineries out there get crude oil and they create a lot of jobs refining it and turning it into various products. If you're just an export facility, you can run a crude oil pipeline to Cherry Point and it'll only take a handful of people to load it onto ships and ship it off to Asia.
And there's something else that I think has just sort of come up recently when we're talking about shipping and shipping rights, and that is noise pollution and the sound. And I know that the Orca Conservancy and a lot of other groups have been really highly concerned about, I mean, we've talked on the show before about how members of the J-Pod have died in record numbers in the past year. And is that something that is in your purview? Does the County Council look at that at all?
Yeah, that's certainly, you know, the environmental impacts are something that we're looking at through these amendments too, not only noise, but, you know, the herring population that's so key to the health of those same orcas has dramatically almost disappeared at Cherry Point. It used to be the healthiest herring population in the Puget Sound, and now it's almost gone. So a whole lot of environmental impacts can be looked at too, and whether the county has any say in how to control those.
Are the amendments they constrictive to future councils? I mean, in other words, you're putting these amendments into a comprehensive plan. Do they shackle governments in the future? I mean, my understanding of these amendments are that they're mostly guidelines and they're principles that future planners and future leaders can look at as they make land use decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the amendments we're looking at are all kind of aspirational and trying to gather information so we know what we can do. You know, anything that a county council puts into place now can be turned around and changed a year from now. So it doesn't constrain what will happen in the future.
Okay, so you've been really helpful and descriptive for those of us who maybe are not as connected to the issue or don't understand. Now, I want you to switch hats a little bit, and if you were King Carl instead of Councilman Carl, and you could have this play out any way you wanted to, what is it that you yourself would like to see happen in this process?
Well, I would like for the local government to know what their strengths are. You know, I would love to be able to, in some way, control the amount of trains coming through here, personally. I mean, we get calls all the time from people, especially up in the Birch Bay area, where trains are sitting on railings running day and night, and people are moving out of their houses because of just the noise and the fumes from those trains. There ought to be a way the local government, acting for the health and welfare of the people, have some say over that. I'm really concerned about climate change and global warming, and I haven't heard a convincing argument why, you know, moving cheap oil from Canada to upgrade what's going on in China so they can burn more and more oil.
Because it's
going
to happen anyway, and it might as well happen for us because of jobs.
That's the argument, but it hasn't happened from the West Coast yet, and the West Coast has stood up to that pretty well, as have a lot of people. Canada's getting pretty desperate to get a pipeline to the coast, and they haven't got one yet.
Which I think has been pretty evident in what Justin Trudeau has made some decisions that have made him a little unpopular. What, in terms of future Canada pipeline opportunities, what strengths do we have or what ability do we have to alter or weigh in on that?
Well, a lot of the discussions on pipelines in Canada right now is because pipelines haven't gone anywhere in the U.S. You know, they tried to put the Keystone pipeline through and that got stalled at this point, I guess, anyway. But now, you know, Trudeau has approved a big Kinder Morgan pipeline that'll go into Burnaby, just north of us here. You know, the ex-premier of British Columbia is on record saying, oh, there's a lot of people that live in Burnaby and Vancouver. Why don't you hop the border at Sumas and take that crude oil to Cherry Point?
And we also have the Trans Mountain pipeline expansion that is underway. Is that correct?
Right. And that pipeline already goes to Cherry Point. So if you expanded it, you know, you could just expand it double or triple and skip all that Vancouver-Burnaby problem.
Right.
So going back to the railroads, I know you're all trying to figure this out, so you may not have a lot of concrete answers because that's the point of these amendments, right? And yet, my understanding is with railroads that the federal government has sort of sway. They have that ability to just make decisions without counties weighing in. Is that true?
I think that's true. And to some degree, I guess from a selfish point of view, I think some of these amendments and asking for the study is to give the county council cover. We have hundreds of people coming and shouting at us to stop this trains, and it'd be nice to have a clear legal opinion that says, we can't. If you want to shout at somebody, go here, because these are the people you need to shout at.
Speaking of people shouting at you, I happened to look at some of the letters regarding the amendments, and man, it came down, unfortunately, it came down to the same sides of we want jobs, we want the environment, we want you to protect this, or we want you to protect that. What would be really helpful for you now as a county councilman, knowing that you have sort of heard those two arguments more than once, what would be really helpful for you to get from us, your constituents? What would you like to hear from us? What would be helpful?
Well, I think what would be really helpful for myself anyway would be clear examples of where local government have shown some control over these types of things in other places. You know, we know the city of Portland passed an ordinance. What was that based on, and do they have that authority? I know with my Pipeline Safety Trust hat on that communities have stopped pipelines in other places using zoning and planning rules to do so. So, you know, clear, concrete examples of where other communities have been successful in these types of things would be extremely important. You know, we're probably going to go out and look for a contract to hire someone to do this. We're also looking for legal opinions to weigh in and help inform that person that we hire about what the opportunities are for local governments.
All right. Well, we are not done with you being on the hot seat, Councilman, and we are going to switch to one of our favorite topics, wells in Whatcom, when we come back right after this.
Are you ready to match wits with your friends and help support KMRE at the same time? Come on down to Goat Mountain Pizza in downtown Bellingham this Wednesday, April 26th at 7 p.m. to participate in KMRE Trivia Night. My name is Riley Sweeney, producer of Bellingham Terror, and I'll be your host. Play pub-style trivia for $5 a person this Wednesday at Goat Mountain Pizza. Come on down!
The Bellingham YWCA welcomes Captain Deborah Dempsey, a trailblazer for women in the maritime industry and the first woman to captain a merchant vessel on the high seas, as keynote speaker for the YWCA Leadership Breakfast May 19th from 7 to 9 a.m. at the Sheraton Four Points Hotel. Proceeds support YWCA emergency and transitional housing for single homeless women and clothing for any low-income Whatcom County woman seeking employment. Details are available at ywcabellingham.org. At Resources, we promote sustainable communities and protect the health of Northwestern Washington's people and ecosystems using science, education, advocacy, and action. We have launched a new project called Washington Goes Solar to help homeowners and businesses learn about current incentives for home and business solar arrays. More information is available on this project and others at re-sources.org.
You are tuned in to KMRE 102.3 FM. Cascadia News Now is what you're listening to. I'm Stephanie Contouris with Dave Willingham, Tim Johnson, and our guest co-host, County Councilman Carl Weimer. And let's turn to one of our favorite subjects, the wells of Whatcom. We have covered it a lot, but I'm going to throw it to you, Dave, to give us a thumbnail description of where we are in terms of the legislative level, in terms of the county level, just for those of us who haven't been paying attention.
Well, where we are is the state Supreme Court has determined that the way permit-exempt wells were being done was incorrect. There have been a couple of proposals in the state legislature this session that would have some of them would have issued more guidance on and some would have changed some rules, some would have added funding for studies. The one that's still alive is the one that would just pretend like this never happened, and we'd go back to the way things were before, and who cares how much water is out there. But that's where we are at the state level right now with that.
And, Carl, it seems like a lot of people are mad at county council.
Yeah, a lot of people are. Some of them even about well issues. And, you know, a lot of people got caught unaware. You know, people go out and buy property. They don't always do their due diligence about Western water law for the last 150 years and, you know, spent a significant amount of money in planning to build a home, and now they find out they can't get legal water. So, you know, there's some legitimate anger there.
Is that always on the person buying property, though? I mean, I guess that's what one thing that seems like with this all these complexities that maybe the county should have been stricter about what people could buy or what, you know, maybe educating people. Where does that responsibility lie? It's a good time to point fingers right now.
But. Right. And I'll try to point them at somebody else.
I think you're doing a great job.
But no, obviously the county has some responsibility, too. We're the land use people here, you know. Counties across the state have always relied on ecology, in-stream flow rules, and guidance to make those decisions, and now this Supreme Court decision says that reliance, you can't rely on the Department of Ecology, which is kind of what I've been saying for years. The Department of Ecology has not been doing their job, and the county does have a responsibility to educate people before they go out and buy land or before they buy land on a shoreline and find out they can't do things because they live on a shoreline. And we have not done a very good job of that education.
And that's the letter that you just sent out last week. Tell us about that.
The resolution we passed last week? Yeah. I mean, we basically sent a resolution to the state legislature saying we need a fix to this, and we went beyond the bill that's still alive that would just put us back to before. That would get the county off the hook, but it wouldn't fix the situation. And basically, it would just change the legal problems for all the well owners out there, because the county would be off the hook, but farmers could sue private property owners because you still have water rights that are senior to others. And that's not well understood.
Right. I have a two-pronged question. The first question is, why does the county act like this is a major surprise? Because if you look at Supreme Court decisions around Washington State, from Postuma to the decision in Yelm, they all were pushing a particular way. And the county seemed to draw a lucky straw when on an appeal, but it didn't look like it was anything that was going to be lasting. So why was the county suddenly caught off guard by this decision? And second thing, why is there so much resistance in the county to having control over its water planning?
Yeah, I think there's two things there, and I'm kind of the odd man out because I was against this appeal all along because I wasn't surprised by the decision. If you've watched water law decisions, the noose has been tightening on counties, and like you said, we kind of drew the short straw. So I'm not sure why the county was surprised, because it was clear to me, and that's why I kept voting against spending money on lawyers to fight about this instead of just dealing with it. My fix would have been we should have joined with the people suing us and turned around and sued the Department of Ecology for not doing their job for the last 20 years. But I didn't win that argument.
But here we are.
Yeah. Clearly, you know, I do feel for why the county is concerned about this, because it's shifting a burden that everybody has thought was the Department of Ecology onto the county, and there could be huge financial impacts with no money coming from the state to help pay for it, even though it has been their responsibility up until this Supreme Court decision.
Now, this legislative fix that's being proposed in Olympia, it still doesn't have any money for counties, right? I mean, it simply just says that a problem that wasn't a problem in the past is still not a problem going into the future, but it doesn't actually have money for you to address these problems.
No, and that's the problem, and that's what we addressed in our resolution, that there's other bills that talk about water mitigation and provides ecology funds to start setting up mitigation plans to deal with the real problem instead of just pretending like it never happened. And that's the ultimate solution we need out of the legislature, not just you can rely on bad ecology guidance, but give ecology money so they can provide good guidance.
So what you're saying is, if I bought some property thinking I could dig a well, and now I can't dig a well, regardless of whether this legislation passes, that you're not even hopeful that it will pass, but even if it did pass, I still can't dig my well.
Well, if it did pass, you probably could dig your well, but you may have a senior water rights owner that a year from now or 5 years from now would sue you and tell you you need to turn your water off.
So it just gets messier and messier.
Yeah, it could get messier and messier without that ultimate solution. And we have a lot of water in the county. We need time to figure out how to move it around. There's a lot of water districts that have water rights, but it's very expensive for someone to tap into those water rights. So there are potential solutions for most of the people that I think are on the hook at this point, but it's going to take some time.
So Snohomish County made a decision that was kind of like splitting the baby. They said, you can apply for, but we can't guarantee you water in the future. Is that something Whatcom County is considering?
We've talked about that, you know, just putting a big disclaimer on there. We'll give you a building permit, but don't come back to us if the ag people next door tell you to turn it off. you know, we're in a little bit different position here in Whatcom County because we're the ones in front of the hearings board that could find us out of compliance and then cost other money, where Snohomish County isn't in that position yet. So we have a little more of a spotlight on us than Snohomish County does.
How many water associations are there in Whatcom County, and can they play a role in helping gather this resource and distribute it appropriately and properly?
Yeah, I don't have the number. There's lots of water associations, and some of them have quite a bit of water, but what people find is their house isn't very close to the water main. So they'll go in to get water, and they'll be told, well, yeah, we'd be glad to give you water. There'll be $200,000 to run a pipe to your house.
Okay. Wow.
So is there a way that maybe those people can drill a well, which is much cheaper, but that water coming out of that well counts as part of that water association's water right, and those people would pay the water association, you know, for that water. You know, the public utility district has a lot of water rights too and has the ability to run pipes around, and those are things that are starting to be talked about. There's groups starting to look at that.
How about water banking? Is that something the county could look at?
Which is?
Well, that would be, it's a complicated topic, but it would mean that people would pay into a particular, into a bank, and water that they weren't using then could be given to people that need water. I mean, that's the basics of it.
Yeah, that's what one of the other counties that has had problems has set up, and that's even kind of what we asked for in our resolution. Part of the mitigation fix, maybe allow people to go forward with building and pay a fee in lieu of, you know, having real legal water at this point while the state and the local governments figure out how to move pipes and share water rights. Mm-hmm.
So this situation is going to get more complicated as more people move here and there's a higher population. And I know you've reached out to the Department of Ecology. Are there other long-term solutions that we're not thinking about or we're not even prepared to deal with right now?
Well, I think it's going to do nothing but get worse. You know, we have somewhere around 15,000 undeveloped lots out in the county, all that could suck water out of, you know, a dwindling resource. And as climate change kicks in, you're going to see that resource dwindle even more. But there's good possibilities, too. The PUD, the City of Bellingham all have large excess water rights. If there's a way to share that, even the Lummi Nation will probably end up with excess water rights. So there may be a way to move this around and provide good growth, but also not hurt salmon and in-stream flows.
Wow. This complicated. We've talked about this every single show for at least the past five shows, and it's complicated, and I admire you for waiting in there and the county council for just trying to deal with it every single week. It must be just intense.
It's been a learning experience.
and we will keep following you and asking you questions. Just our last minute, I wanted to give a shout out, two quick shout outs, one really fast to our next President of the State of Washington, Attorney General Bob Ferguson. He's been amazing this week, and I vote for him for King of Washington if we ever secede. Very quickly, he defended the voter-approved state minimum wage, saying that his office will defend the will of the voters at every level. He filed an amicus brief in support of the state of Hawaii, their challenge to President Trump's revised travel ban, saying courts continue to recognize the president's travel ban is illegal. And just today, he filed federal civil rights case over sexual harassment of agricultural workers and discriminatory hiring practices. Thanks for that tip, Tim. Yay, Attorney General Bob Ferguson. I expect to see more big things out of him. And yay to the city of Bellingham for unofficially adopting the official flag of Bellingham. good on ya. It's very green. We are Cascadia News Now. I'd like to thank our citizen journalist tonight, Liz Darrow, for her excellent report. Thank you so much, Councilman Weimer, for being on the show and helping us navigate those choppy waters. Our co-hosts are Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham. Dave Willingham, also our technical director, our fabulous engineer, Devlin Sweeney. And I'm Stephanie Contours. If you are listening to this live on Wednesday, we are headed over to Goat Mountain to play trivia for KMRE, just $5, and you can defeat the Cascadia News team if you dare and have bragging rights forever. You are tuned into KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham, KMRE.org.